From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In Surfside, Florida, rescue teams are in the fifth day of a painstaking and dangerous effort to find any life at the site of the collapsed condominium building. The teams are working carefully to protect themselves as well as anyone who might be alive underneath. Only one person, a teenager, was pulled alive from the rubble, and that was last week.
And another body was recovered today. The death toll has risen to 10, 150 people still unaccounted for. There are also more questions about the structural integrity of the 40-year-old building, problems that surfaced in a 2018 report. We're joined now by Veronica Zaragovia of member station WLRN in Miami. Veronica, welcome.
Thank you so much, Peter.
You were at the site on Saturday. Your colleagues from WLRN have continued to report from there through the weekend and into today. How are they describing the work that's going on there now?
Well, over the weekend, the teams there have dug a 40-foot deep trench, and it's helped them to find the additional deceased people who have been found. But the efforts are continuing around the clock. At least the fire has been contained now. So we've been going every day, and there were points where it was pretty bad. I mean, that just you could smell it, and it was hard to see, and the debris, and that's been contained better now. So it's helping the rescue efforts, because now they don't have as much of that smoke in the air. But it's still going on, yeah.
But at this point, are rescuers hearing any signs of potential life whatsoever?
So I haven't heard about them hearing signs, although they are still using dogs and sonar and cameras. And I think that officials are hesitant to say they're not hearing anything, because we've been hearing that the message continues to be search and rescue, and hope. And they refuse to, say that they're going to move on now to recovery. I don't know if it's to protect the loved ones of people who are deceased or missing, but they're just not telling us yet that they're giving up on finding anyone else.
Well, you say hope, but at this point, that's got to be hard to come by for people who are now, as we said, into day five of this rescue operation.
Yes, it's certainly difficult. I mean, when I spoke to, for instance, on Saturday, I met Ileana Monteagudo, and she fortunately was able to run out. She was on the sixth floor, but she was talking about her neighbors in the past tense. And she spoke to me in Spanish, and she was just really shaken up.
Sí, aquí Miami siempre ha sido un pueblo muy solidario, tanto los cubanos como cualquier latinoamericano, como los mismos hebreos.
She was saying there that the one good thing about all of this is just confirming how in Miami and here in Surfside, everybody has come together, whether they're Catholic, Christian, Jewish, whatever race or religion, people are just really united in solidarity, in just wanting to, heal from something so horrible. And she mentioned that she explained how she ran out, and she's so thankful that she's saved her life, but she's left with nothing. And I know sometimes people think she's ungrateful, but she's just saying that she's lost everything, and that's also very difficult.
Yeah, I have less than a minute here, Veronica, but I want you to tell us about this engineering report from 2018 that called out some of the significant structural issues that people had been noticing in the building, cracks in the concrete columns, structural damage to a slab under the pool deck. What can you tell us about that?
That's right. Well, the 2018 report did not indicate that the building was at risk of collapse. And so they're investigating, how maybe that's a flaw in the report, potentially. It wasn't clear whether the problem ultimately contributed to the building's collapse, those concrete issues that you mentioned. But it's led to the town of Surfside to hire a renowned structural engineering firm that was on hand after the 9/11 attack at the Pentagon and a bridge that collapsed here at Florida International University in Miami. So it's leading to more teams, coming down for a thorough inspection.
Veronica, we got to leave it there. Veronica Zaragovia from WLRN, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Well, the Belarusian dissidents, whose arrest last month after their commercial flight was forced to land, have been moved from a harsh KGB prison to house arrest in Belarus. But that incident is far from over. The U.S. and other Western countries accuse Belarus, a Russian ally, of hijacking a Ryanair flight using a phony bomb threat so they could arrest Roman Protasevich and his girlfriend Sofia Sapega. The two now face charges that could mean years in prison. They are part of the opposition to hardline Belarusian leader Alexander Lukashenko, claiming he stole last year's election from Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, who's been living in exile ever since. She's calling on Belarus to release its political prisoners, including her own husband. And Svetlana joins us now on Skype from neighboring Lithuania. And first, your thoughts on news that Roman Protasevich, the main target of the airplane grab, and his girlfriend are under house arrest.
Yes, they were brought from KGB prison to house arrest. But I have to say that house arrest is not freedom. It's just another type of imprisonment. Roman and his and Sofia are controlled. They are surveilled by KGB. It's not the freedom we want them to be.
Yeah. Well, and we mentioned your husband. We should remind people he was the candidate for president, the opposition leader, when he was arrested a year ago. You stepped in and took his place, became the candidate. Most Western countries agree that Lukashenko, who's sometimes called Europe's dictator, rigged that election. You're now in exile. Your husband's going on trial. Have you been able to communicate with him at all?
No, for more than 1 year, I haven't had any communication with Sergei. We can communicate only through the lawyer. And on the first day of so-called trial in prison, I saw shots from the trial. And I'm really glad that I had opportunity to see him, because I'm really glad that he hasn't changed. Mm-hmm. He's so strong. He is so brave. And we really don't know what's going on during these trials, because, you know, the lawyer only can say about his physical and moral state, and he keeps rather well.
Well, after Belarus forced that flight carrying Roman and Sofia last month, the EU, the U.S. and Canada announced coordinated sanctions against President Lukashenko's government. He accuses Western governments of a conspiracy against Belarus. He's promising retaliatory measures. But do you think the sanctions are having an effect? What else or what instead would you want to see the U.S. and other Western countries do?
You know, first of all, I'm really grateful to democratic countries, EU countries, the USA and Canada and the UK for joint position about Belarus, for clear messages that the USA in particular will stand for values, for democracy. And we are grateful to President Biden that he raised the question of Belarus during the meeting of G7 summit and with Putin. But I have to say that sanctions are not a silver bullet, but this is the leverage that can help to stop violence.
Look, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, there are other dissidents on trial with your husband, journalists, other leading opposition candidates. Lukashenko's government suppressed protests after last year's election, which most Western countries agree was rigged. I'm just wondering, as you are in exile, what your thoughts are on watching what's happening here in the United States. We have former President Trump, who just this past weekend, once again, claimed that our last election was rigged, was stolen from him, even though that's a lie. That's not true. In your country, there's agreement that it was true. What do you see as you watch this false mirroring happening here in the United States?
You know, the USA is a democratic country, and no, I'm sure you have proofs that elections were fine, and we have proof that our elections were rigged. And we have to stand to defend, to fight for our right to elect whoever we want. And, you know, it's easier to prove this in the USA because you are democratic.
You know, I'm wondering if you're also thinking, you don't know from stolen elections, you know, we genuinely had one. Svetlana, thank you so much. By the way, what do you do when you're in exile?
You know, my life now is a fight. Fight for political prisoners, fight against regime, fight against violence. I am in constant dialogue with Belarusians who are fighting inside country. We inspire each other, and everybody does what he or she can. Sometimes it's very little, but it's so important because the situation is awful, it's painful, it's devastating in Belarus, and people are really frightened and scared by the level of repressions. People don't feel safe on the streets, in their houses. They can be kidnapped at any moment, and their relatives will not know for a couple of days where they are. And while everybody doing a little, 8 million of little is already an ocean of opportunities. And despite of this huge level of violence, people continue to fight as they can.
That's Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, exiled Belarusian opposition leader. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
When millions of people suddenly shifted to working from home 15 months ago, it was not a smooth transition for everyone. But over time, many people actually came to like it. And now, with companies starting to call workers back to the office, a lot of them don't want to go back. A recent survey found that 87% of people who've been working remotely during the pandemic would prefer to keep doing so at least one day a week. And 42% say if their employer doesn't offer the option to work from home permanently, they'll quit. Dori Clark is an author who teaches at Duke University's Fuqua School of Business. Dori, welcome.
Thank you, Peter. Great to be here.
And when you hear those numbers, does it surprise you that the vast majority of workers who started working remotely during the pandemic want to keep doing it? And if their employers don't, they're willing to walk.
Well, it actually makes a lot of sense. One of the biggest stressors in a person's day is their commute. And so being able to completely eliminate that, save an hour, sometimes even 2 hours a day, actually dramatically increases people's happiness. And when you take on top of that, the fact that many people, if they were having conflicts at their job, maybe they didn't like some of their coworkers, they didn't like their boss, it enables them to de-escalate that situation when working from home. So it really is an optimal situation for many workers, at least 1 or 2 days a week.
Yeah, so this is going to be a transition period, an adjustment for millions of people who've gotten used to working from home. What do you think those workers should keep in mind in this time of transition as companies start to call them back?
Well, this is very much a liminal time. The norms have not been set. We've never been through this previously. And so this is really the first time that workplaces have had to navigate these questions. And so even if your workplace says, we are implementing a universal policy, here's what it's going to be, you may actually have some latitude, especially if you are a valued employee, especially if you have built up political capital because you've been there a long time, or if people really like you, or if you're in a critical role, where you actually may have more of an ability than you think to raise your hand and say, you know, I'm actually not really comfortable with this. I'd like something different. Your employer may actually be willing to accommodate that.
Well, to that point, you wrote a piece recently in the Harvard Business Review that offers people some pretty good advice if they're considering changing jobs right now. First of all, don't just quit. Talk to your boss about these things.
That's exactly right. We're coming into a period now where studies estimate that anywhere from half to at the high end to maybe a quarter of employees at the low end are considering strongly leaving their jobs post-pandemic. So there is likely going to be an enormous amount of turnover. Because of that, employers are much more willing than usual to say, oh, wow, if all these people are leaving, we really need to bend over backwards to keep our prized employees. So this is actually
That's interesting. You think they're motivated to keep their employees?
Yes. If you were an employer and you have a wave of employees that are thinking of quitting, beginning to put in notice, it can really create a panic. And so it gives employees much more leverage than they would normally have. They don't want you to go. And so they might be willing to make changes and adjustments. It could mean more money. It could mean more flexibility. It could mean if you don't like your boss, you have the ability to change to a different department because they don't want to lose you.
So, okay, so as you say, these workers have leverage. They can go to their boss, ask for what they want. But that can be a tricky situation, even if you're in the driver's seat. So how should people approach that conversation?
Well, the first thing to keep in mind is if you really are unsure if you want to leave, or if you would like to stay if certain conditions could be met, then you owe it to yourself and you owe it to your employer to at least give them the opportunity to meet those needs. You can go to them and in a constructive way say, hey, I would love to continue working here, but I'm having some challenges. I'm having some frustrations. Let me explain what that is. And it could be a need or a desire to continue working from home. It could be that you feel like you've stagnated. You want a new challenge, and see what they say. The key is not to do it in an angry way, not to be issuing ultimatums, but instead to come to the table as a collaborative partner and say, look, I'd like to stay here if I can. What can we do?
Huh. We really are in uncharted territory, aren't we? People are burnt out. They're reconsidering their priorities. Many feel as though they've been stagnating for the last year and a half because they've been locked up at home. This is really tough stuff, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And I think an important point is that if you're feeling tired, if you're feeling burned out, your manager probably is as well. And even though in our ideal world, a good manager would be scanning the horizon and looking for opportunities to help develop his or her employees, that probably hasn't been happening for the past year. And so that means that you have to be the captain of your own career.
Dori Clark, marketing strategist and author who teaches at Duke University's Fuqua School of Business. Dori, thanks very much. Appreciate it.
I really appreciate it. Thanks, Peter. Great talking with you.
Well, John P. Desereaux has been the captain of his career. Before COVID hit, he was a DJ in New York City. Of course, that work disappeared overnight when socializing became taboo. But now, even though New York is reopening, bars and nightclubs are revving back up, John is not going back. He has changed careers entirely. John, welcome.
Hi. It's great to be here.
It's good to have you. And tell me how COVID gave you the kick that you needed to change up your career.
Well, when everything shut down, my world shut down. So I had more time to really think about what I was doing and what I wanted to be doing.
And what is it that you were doing and wanted to be doing?
Illustration and artwork had always been a passion of mine. And while DJing was fun, I felt it important to make a shift. The world was so scary during the pandemic that it forced me to sit and think about what I really wanted to be doing.
Hmm. Can you talk about that process and how long it took for you to realize that there actually might be an opportunity in this otherwise awful situation?
Well, you figure everything started to shut down around March. By the time summer was starting to come close, I realized that I wouldn't be going back to work anytime soon. And my greatest escape was to just really be in my studio and to be drawing and to be reading comics and to be working on artwork. And from there, I just felt the opportunity come over me where I was like, I can take all the time I need to really work on this, and that was the smartest and safest thing for me to do.
Would you have done it? Would you have made that leap if the DJ work didn't just vanish overnight?
I was trying to do both at the same time for a long time. And when everything shut down, there was nothing else for me to consider. I couldn't decide to put my pencil down and stop drawing and go and DJ. So the world gave me that focus because everything shut down.
Kind of odd, isn't it, though? Because you're in New York City, the sort of epicenter in the United States for so long. So much, you know, pain and trauma happening to so many people there. And yet there are these silver linings, these opportunities to restart, even amidst all that struggle.
There was so much trauma and so much stress, and it was so sad that I really focused and thought, you know, how do I want to spend my time? It was a way for me to actually cope with everything going on.
Did the unemployment benefits that Congress passed and extended because of COVID, did you draw on any of those, and did that help you?
It did. It helped me a ton. I got very lucky with that, and I'm sure a lot of people did, because I was an independent gig worker as a DJ. So otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to get unemployment. So to have the unemployment really helped because it also allowed me to not have to worry about money for that time period.
So tell me, how's the new gig going? How did you start pitching your illustration work and getting jobs and getting started in this new field?
Everybody was home. So I figured art directors and editors and magazine people and advertising people that they were all home just like I was. So I started emailing them with my artwork, and I would ask them what they thought, and I would ask them for any tips. I wouldn't necessarily just ask for work. I would just ask them to give me some feedback. One thing started leading to another, and someone would recommend me to somebody else, and then eventually people started hiring me.
Who's hiring you these days?
I worked with Vanity Fair, The New Yorker, The New York Times. I haven't worked with NPR yet, but maybe that'll happen soon.
Well, my goodness, you go from being a DJ, COVID hits, and now all of a sudden you're working for some of the biggest news organizations in the country. I mean, congratulations to you. It's sort of proof
thank you.
You can take a leap and it can work.
Yeah, absolutely. You have to just put your focus and dedication to it. If it's something that you want, no matter what you're doing, you should give it some time. And that would be kind of my biggest recommendation, is give your passion some hours so that when the opportunity does come, you can really give it your full on and know exactly where you want to be.
Is this it for you? I mean, will you ever go back to DJing or working in the service industry?
The best part of what I do now as an illustrator is I get hired for me. I get hired to put my signature on something and to create artwork to help tell a story. If I can get some of that energy DJing where I'm being booked for me, then maybe I would consider it. But to work for other people and to be up late nights and to be around drunk people, I don't really miss it.
Yeah. John P. Desereaux is an illustrator in New York City, made the career switch during COVID and appears to be doing quite well for himself. John, thanks very much and congratulations.
Thank you very much. And I look forward to hearing from NPR to do some illustration work.
All right. Thanks, John.
NPR's No Compromise podcast just won the Pulitzer Prize. We explore a breed of gun rights activism that's online, organized, and unwilling to budge. I'm Chris Haxel.
I'm Lisa Hagen. Check out No Compromise wherever you get your podcasts.
The waters have been calmed. That's the word from Republican Senator Mitt Romney on CNN's State of the Union yesterday, talking about that smaller $1.2 trillion bipartisan deal on infrastructure that appears to be back on track after President Biden walked back his statement that it would be tied to his much larger plan, something that set off Republicans. So what happens now? NPR congressional correspondent Sue Davis is here. Hi, Sue.
Hey there.
And to remind us, this deal would invest in roads, bridges, high-speed internet. And it hit the rocks after President Biden said late last week he wouldn't sign it unless Congress also voted on his more expensive spending bill. He said they were in tandem. So how'd he smooth that out?
You know, he didn't actually use the V word, veto, but that was certainly the implication in his remarks, saying that he wouldn't sign the bipartisan deal, a deal unless it was coupled with a separate measure. You know, the White House, in a rare move, walked it back really quickly over the weekend and made clear, the president made clear, that it was not a veto threat that he was issuing over the bill. And he had to sort of calm the waters a little bit. You had several Republican senators indicating that they could withdraw their support for the bipartisan deal if they were conditioned upon the two. But one thing I think needs to be understood here is that Democrats have been very, very clear for months that they would pursue this two-track strategy. I think that the president just suggesting that the fate of one depended on the other required a little bit of massaging.
Yeah, and this was not a surprise, as you said. But how are progressives in the Democratic Party feeling about Biden walking it back?
Yeah, I mean, the end strategy here hasn't really changed. And as Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said last week, you can't do one without the other. Progressives, especially in the House, are not going to vote for the bipartisan deal, the $1.2 trillion package, unless they have some kind of assurances that the second budget reconciliation package is going to be signed into law. Now, this is in the very early stages, and you know, but they are looking at an additional sidecar measure of potentially trillions of dollars of Democratic priorities. So if they can't get that through, the chances of the bipartisan deal getting through also get pretty narrow. So their fates are really intertwined here.
Yeah. And where is President Biden on the votes?
Well, I think that it's pretty clear that if nothing more dramatic happens, they have the 60 votes they need in the Senate for the $1.2 trillion deal. The plan is to spend the month of July getting that bill written and through the Senate, and also that Democrats need to come up with a budget resolution that will set the targets for what they want to do with this second package, including anything they might want to do with revenue and spending, and then send it to the committees to write the bill. So there's going to be a lot of action in July, but frankly, you know, when will the bills be signed into law is the question everyone wants to know. This is likely to be a legislative battle that carries well into the fall, maybe even into the holiday season.
Well, and Democrats may fast track some of Biden's other priorities through with this so-called budget reconciliation. What are we likely to see there?
That's a great question. I mean, Democrats have talked about looking at everything from an expansion of Medicare to more money for childcare, elder care, climate change, maybe even immigration. So the universe is really big right now. What they need to do is narrow that universe. And the two big questions here are what's going to be in it and how much is it going to cost? Senate Budget Chairman Bernie Sanders has indicated that he could go as high as $6 trillion for all these measures. I think that number is probably a little high. You're unlikely to get more moderate Democrats on board. But finding that magic number that can get Bernie Sanders and West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin both agreeing to something is going to be really tricky.
Yes, just that sentence alone. NPR congressional correspondent Sue Davis, thank you.
You're welcome.
Millions of formerly incarcerated people across the country were eligible to vote in the 2020 election, thanks to new laws in at least 13 states that have passed in recent years. But some new reporting suggests that relatively few of them actually did. Nicole Lewis is a staff writer for the Marshall Project, a news organization that focuses on criminal justice. Nicole, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
Sure. And first of all, tell me about what some states have been doing to restore voting rights for people who've been in prison. What's that look like right now?
Sure. So over the past several years, there's really been a sea change around felony disenfranchisement laws. And so many states have started to rethink the way that we take these rights away from people who have felony convictions. And so, you know, we've seen an expansion of the number of people who are on probation or parole, who've gotten out of prison, are now eligible to vote. Florida may be the most sort of well-known example of just restoring voting rights through an amendment. It was sort of curtailed by the legislature. In some cases, it's executive orders restoring rights. And in some cases, the legislature has taken it upon themselves to change the laws altogether.
Red states and blue states.
That's correct.
So you dug into the voter rolls in four different states in particular, Nevada, Kentucky, Iowa, and New Jersey. And when you did that, what did you find?
What we found was that no more than one in four of the eligible people, based on the law changes, re-registered in time for the 2020 election. And that rate is much, much lower than the registration rate for the general public, which hovers around 75% pretty much every year.
And you say that most of the people whose rights were recently restored actually didn't even know it. Why is that?
That's right. So a lot of the times when we talk about formerly incarcerated voters, when we look at registration and turnout based on the limited data that we have, there's this narrative that formerly incarcerated people don't turn out, they don't vote. And I think it makes it very, very easy to assume that they're just simply not interested, right? That lack of turnout is a representation of disinterest on their part. But when we dug a little bit deeper and we looked into the laws and we started talking to the people who were actually working to register these folks, what we found is that not a single state that we looked at, right, actually required the agencies that work with formerly incarcerated people. So whether that be the Department of Corrections, the Department of Probation and Parole, in some cases, right, the Secretary of State might have a list. None of those agencies were actually required to notify people. And so this is a huge deal when we're talking about felony disenfranchisement laws, because for so long, voting with a felony conviction, even if you were out of prison, could mean going back to prison. So people really need to know that now they're eligible and they won't face that risk or they won't face that penalty. And so if we don't tell them anything, you know, that idea that it's illegal to vote with a felony conviction still persists.
So what's the outreach like? I mean, are groups starting to realize that if you don't do the sort of voter education that you're talking about, that people aren't going to register?
Yeah, so the voter registration drives have been sort of mixed. And so we really looked and were interested in what people were doing leading into the 2020 election, right? So it's a big pivotal moment in our country. And most of the work was left to political organizers who were already doing kind of get out the vote work more generally in their communities. They're hampered a little bit by the pandemic, of course, in 2020. You know, formerly incarcerated people can be much harder to find and they have no voting history. So we don't have like a last known address or a sort of record for the last place they registered. So they had to really be creative, you know, using social media, trying where they could to get lists from the corrections departments or the Secretary of State, in some cases going to halfway houses and doing outreach that way. It was really a myriad of strategies, you know, persuading certain agencies to say, hey, actually, what if you just sent everybody on probation a letter? That would really help us out. And so, you know, progress was really mixed, but it looked like a lot of on-the-ground work to really dispel those myths and encourage people to say, you know, this is actually really important for you and for your community.
So education and outreach important, but how much of this is about people not being interested? And I know you kind of, I don't want to say dismissed that idea before, but to some extent, I think people who have been incarcerated must feel alienated from society and that, you know, participating in the political process, it doesn't work or it's something that they're not interested in.
Absolutely. So I think that it actually is really important to think about how these people have been alienated because of their experiences with the justice system. And so, you know, we don't ever want to say, or I felt like the narrative around, you know, people who are formerly incarcerated don't turn out and don't vote because they're not interested. And that's the sort of, you know, final point was incomplete. And so my reporting helped to sort of build, flesh that out, right? And so we do find and we do hear all the time that people feel alienated by the justice system. They feel like their voices don't matter, their vote doesn't count. They have a sense that they don't have the same amount of power or agency. And so for many people, right, even when you're faced with an organizer who's saying you can vote for the first time, isn't this exciting? They may say, you know, hey, no, I'm not interested. I'm not going to do that. In some cases, I also heard that people were very cautious because they are fearful of any kind of retaliation from the state. And so these are particularly people who are on probation and parole, and they're saying, well, like, I can't vote for the judge or I can't vote for the sheriff. These are law enforcement officials. You know, I'm a little bit worried about what could happen. And again, it just speaks to that fear, their experiences moving through the justice system, and how difficult it is once you get out to kind of overcome and find your place again in, you know, civil society.
Yeah. Now, some people did know their rights were restored and they were interested in getting out and voting on Election Day. What did you hear from those people who got out there and exercised that right?
Yeah, a few of the people that I spoke to for this story were really excited about the possibility of voting for elected officials who oversee the justice system. And so, you know, I'm thinking of one man named Jovan Jackson, who's based in Nevada. And, you know, he just had this clear sense of, this is the first time that someone like me, someone from the community that I come from, you know, there's high rates of poverty, you know, over-policing, actually gets to decide who, you know, makes the laws here, you know, who enforces them. We get to pick the sheriff, and he could see a clear connection into why that makes a difference already in some of the sort of freshman legislators introducing new bills that are directly aimed at lowering criminal penalties for certain crimes. And it's just sort of an opportunity to say, for so long we haven't had a voice, and now we do.
When some of these bills or measures first passed, I know we had spoken on this program about what impact these new voters could have on elections, especially in states like Florida, which you have mentioned already in this conversation. Now that we have some data from 2020, is there any evidence that these new voters did change the outcomes of elections in any way?
So as far as we can tell, there is not. And I will highlight another analysis that happened specifically in Florida, and I believe it was the Tampa Bay Times and the Miami Herald and ProPublica tried to get a sense of, you know, did this new block of voters, you know, swing the presidential election in one way or the other? And what we found was, no, they're not. They may be registered in higher numbers, but turnout, you know, is much sort of lower. Another really important component to this story is that there has been an assumption about who these voters are and how they're going to vote in elections. And I think by and large, the narrative has been that all of these people are Democrats, that any kind of increased voter turnout, any kind of restoration of rights only goes to support the Democrats. And what we found, and this is a separate study that we did looking at the politics of currently incarcerated people. So we did a survey last year. We heard from 8,000 currently incarcerated people spread out all across the country about their political beliefs. And we found there's actually an incredible diversity of political thought behind bars, and that, you know, restoring voting rights to people who are formerly incarcerated doesn't necessarily mean it's going to boost one party or the other. You know, these voters are really up for grabs. They don't have a track record. They don't have a history of voting. And so the issues that speak to them become much more important than any kind of party affiliation.
Nicole Lewis, a staff writer for the Marshall Project, thank you very much.
Thank you.
There is some progress to report in the battle against COVID-19 around the world. A handful of countries, such as Australia, Vietnam, New Zealand, have reported relatively low numbers of cases. But in Mexico, the number of reported cases and deaths continues to climb, now to a total of 2.5 million cases, with more than 233,000 deaths. So let's spend a few minutes on this with NPR correspondent Carrie Kahn, who's in Mexico City. Hi, Carrie.
Hi.
And this rise is in parts of Mexico, but this week the country reported 5,340 new confirmed cases, 221 deaths. What are health experts saying?
Well, some are warning that we may be seeing a third wave. In some areas of the country, there have been large increases in the past few weeks. And it's kind of crazy because just a month ago, we were reporting how the pandemic is decreasing continually, steady after steady drops in cases and especially deaths. Here in Mexico City, we saw authorities lift many restrictions on bars, movie houses, you know, indoor dining. Capacity limits were lifted in a lot of places. And also there's been a fixture of the epidemic here. It's a 7 p.m. nightly broadcast of COVID reports given by the Undersecretary of Health. And those were ended, too. He's sort of the Dr. Fauci of Mexico, and he's become this minor celebrity in his own right. And his conferences were cut off because the decreases were so great. I think cases were down 85% since the highs in January. And a lot of that hospital capacity that was built up during the pandemic, too, had been started being dismantled in many places in the country. This week, we've seen cases about 15 to 18% over last week. And it's an increase, you know, after, like I said, those months of great decreases. And we're seeing in many places the Delta variant here. But deaths still remain low, and those infected are appearing to be younger and younger people.
Well, we, of course, hear a lot about the Delta variant, which was first seen in India, and it has higher transmissibility. It's more infectious. So that could be one possible problem. And we're also hearing those infected and hospitalized might be younger.
Yes, that's true. But most of these cases are occurring, that these spikes that we're seeing are in states that have large tourism industries. Cases are up greatly in Baja California Sur. That's home of the twin resorts of Los Cabos. They're also up in the state of Quintana Roo, and that's where the beach hotspots of Tulum and Cancun are, and also all over the Yucatan Peninsula. They're seeing some of the highest rates since the pandemic.
Well, just for a second here, these are tourist areas. What do American tourists, for instance, need to know? I mean, when you fly into Mexico, do they seek proof of vaccination? What's happening there?
nope, nothing. You can come into Mexico. You don't need to show proof of vaccination. And there has been a steady rise in U.S. tourists coming to Mexico, mostly because U.S. tourists can't go to other countries. So they've been just flocking to Mexico. But when you do leave the country, you have to have a negative COVID test. So that's something to think about, because if for some reason you have contracted COVID in these states with high COVID rates right now, you would have to quarantine for 14 days and pay for that, and then could not return to the U.S. without a negative test.
Well, and the important thing you're saying is when you're going there, you're heading to an area that has had, you know, a peak, a rise in COVID-19 cases. So be aware that you're going to an area that has these cases. Maybe a third wave, you say. Are there enough hospital beds and equipment?
Well, like I said, they had started dismantling the excess capacity that they had built up around it. But there is believed to be right now, yes, there is. But we're seeing the rises in this area in Mexico City, the Valley area, which is home to Mexico City and the surrounding state of Mexico. That's where the hotspot had been, especially during the real rise we saw in January and February and December. And so a lot of that capacity has been taken down. So they may start bringing a lot of that back up too. Yeah. And in these states where they've seen these hotspots.
Yeah. And you tell us only 6% of the Mexican population has been fully vaccinated. What's going on there?
Well, the president says he wants all Mexicans over the age of 18 to have at least one dose by October. But that's going to be a tough goal to meet. Yeah. Around 22% have had at least one dose. But there was one estimate I was reading that it could take 840 days at the current rate of vaccination for all Mexicans over 18 to get a complete vaccination. Mexican officials insist as soon as they get the vaccines, they put them into people's arms. There was some reporting just last week that showed that right before critical midterm elections, those took place in the first week of June, vaccinations were on the rise, and critics were cynically saying, you know, the government wanted to make a good show of vaccinations before the elections. And indeed, there has been a dramatic drop in the number of vaccinations after the elections. But the government says they're doing the best they can in getting as many as they can. The U.S. Just donated over 1 million Johnson & Johnson vaccines. And the government had a very successful campaign of administering those in four cities that border the U.S. Mexico is very anxious to get cross-border restrictions lifted as soon as possible. And they're hoping if they can raise that vaccination rate along the border to those of U.S. border cities, then the U.S. may release those restrictions.
Boy, NPR's Carrie Kahn in Mexico City, a cautionary tale. Carrie, thank you.
You're welcome.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.